This is Larry Magid of CBS News. Regardless of how old or young we are, we all grew up with automation. Certainly, if you go back to the 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond, there are a lot of things that used to require manual labor that are now done by machines. But what is automation? I got an answer from Ken Goldberg, a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at Berkeley, and an editor of a new journal called IEEE Transactions on Automation Science and Engineering.
Actually, the term automation goes back to 1947, when it was coined right after World War II, when there was interest in, you know, those big IBM-type computers.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, it's sort of slipped down. It's moved down in this sort of coolness factor, and it doesn't really hold a candle to robotics, which is where all the action is these days.
You mean like that vacuum cleaner that runs around? It looks a little like a dog that runs around and
yeah, exactly.
House.
Well, that's a perfect example. Everybody calls that a robot. But I would call that automation. So the difference, from my perspective, is that automation is where you want to do something over and over again, repetitively, over long periods. So you want them to be sustained operation. And there's many examples of this. The ones you just gave, which is like the factory, is obviously the first one that comes to mind, is the assembly lines. And sort of mindless machines just welding or screwing in a nut.
Uh-huh.
But we're very interested in expanding that and thinking more broadly about all the variety of applications that are out there that range from everything from toll booths to voting machines to home security to things like the vacuum cleaner.
Hey, well, voting machines. Now, are you suggesting instead of us going to the polls, we just have computers vote? They might actually make better decisions.
They might. Actually, that would be the optimum situation. But right now, I mean, you know, there's huge controversies about what's going on with voting machines.
Absolutely, and there's a lot of concern about them.
Yes, and those are legitimate because these are systems that are currently closed, and no one knows exactly, you know, what they're vulnerable as.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we're interested in is developing better scientific foundations for machines like that.
But a voting machine, I mean, the tabulation is automated, but of course the process, the human being still has to vote, and obviously none of us want to give that up, although very few of us exercise it, but that's another issue. But so that's a case where what? It's taking the place of that old process of human beings having to tabulate the votes.
Right. And one of the things that happens is I think that automation is very much where databases, for example, were in the 1960s. There are many examples of where they're out there and they're working, but they're patched together with a lot of ad hoc tricks of the trade. So the voting machines are a perfect example. Someone kind of goes into a back room and sort of patches something together and it works. But the problem is there's no sense of reliability, of precision in such
mm-hmm.
a machine. And that's where we need a science. And the science for databases was relational algebra.
Which I failed, I think, in high school.
Right. Well, it was a huge breakthrough. And what mathematicians came in and they said, hey, listen, let's develop the right abstractions, the right mathematical models. Then we can prove theorems about this stuff. And we can actually put it on a very solid footing so that you can make guarantees about how your databases are going to perform.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Goldberg, you may not be aware of this, but I was actually an automation expert back in the 1960s because I spent a great deal of time studying a broadcast called The Jetsons and learned all about what the 21st century would look like. And for some reason, it doesn't look anywhere near like that, except for maybe the iRobot vacuum cleaner. So I guess my first question is, did something go wrong? Why are we not more automated than we are? Or am I missing something?
It turned out to be a lot harder than we thought. And that is because the world is complicated and changes, and there's a lot more variables. So having robots in a home to really do something like pick up after a kid or really put things away after a dinner party, that's a hard problem.
Why is that hard? I mean, I can do it, not very well, but at least so my wife says. But seriously, it seems pretty easy to me. Why is that so hard for a machine to do, yet so easy for a human to do?
Yeah, because, well, you've had the benefit of millions of years of evolution. So you've got very fine-tuned sensors. You can identify what's a plate, and you can look around a corner. You can, if something is slippery, your fingers can adjust. These are all things that we're still working on in terms of robotics and automation.
I mean, even though we all agree computers have better memories than we do, and they're usually faster than we are, there's something about their perceptual abilities that's lacking?
That's right. It's a perception and ability to adapt. Now, the one thing that they do much better than us is do things over and over again exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And we're bad at that. We get bored. We get frustrated.
We get tired sometimes.
Yeah. And, you know, this is kind of work that nobody should do. That's the work that a robot should do.
But look at speech recognition. That's come an enormous way over the last number of years. Why is that able to do so well, yet something as simple as washing the dishes still requires, or at least putting the dishes away still requires a human being?
Right. Well, speech recognition is a great example where the machine learning has made enormous inroads. And this is statistical methods. And going back to the foundations of statistics, it's been embraced by researchers and is yielding tremendous results. In the physical world where you have to interact with physics, there's still elements of basic mechanics and physical interactions that we don't understand well enough.
When I think of what works well, and maybe this is because I'm most familiar with it, obviously things that can be done through software on a computer seem to work well. We machinists, when it comes to rote tasks, can often be replaced by machines that simply carry out that activity. Yet artists are still pretty much a human process. I mean, I'm trying to get a sense as to, you know, where things are going, what are the limitations, and what can we humans rely upon, for some job security going into the future?
Well, I think that one of the areas is going to be anything that involves anything creative, inventing something new, developing something that involves the human interface. That's very hard to automate. The area that I think there's enormous opportunities, though, is in the drudgery, work that no one wants to do. And that's work that we really need to develop robots for. So, you know, car washes, the toll booth collecting. I mean, that's a perfect example.
Well, it's interesting you bring this up because we're in the middle of a big national crisis over the whole issue of immigration. And what you're describing are not completely, but some of these are the kind of entry-level or low-level minimum wage jobs. Toll booths may be different because it's government work, but certainly things like car washes or picking, I don't know if you can automate the picking of vegetables, things of that nature. These are jobs that are very much caught up in the immigration debate.
Well, that's true. And actually, I just came back from China, and there we have a similar, the issue of immigration is relevant because there's a concern what happens as the cost of labor starts to slowly increase, which is happening there and elsewhere in the world. And, for example, in China, there's a huge interest in automation. And they're building all the major automation companies are opening up offices and research labs in China because that's where the big growth area is. Not only has to do with labor, but it's also quality,
mm-hmm.
that these machines can do things better than humans.
But take something like picking vegetables. I mean, that requires a fair amount of dexterity, judgment. That strikes me as perhaps something that would be difficult. Am I right about that?
You're absolutely right. And that's a perfect example where we can't engineer vegetables to all turn out the same way, at least not yet.
Let's hope we don't.
Right. So that is a tricky problem. So you go out into a field with strawberries or zucchinis, and every one of those is slightly different. So it's very hard to make a machine that will solve that problem.
So where is the forefront of automation?
It goes back to factories to start. One of them is factories are still really in the 1960s. The way if you design a new mechanism, say a new iPod or something like that, it takes 6 months for a factory to get geared up to produce those in volume. What we really need is a scientific method that will, say, take the CAD model for the parts you've designed and automatically configure a factory. You'll hit a button, all the parts will be ordered, you'll screw them together, and you'll be in production in 2 weeks.
So you're saying basically the almost automating the process of automating the creation of that production line.
Exactly, Larry. It's starting to think about interchangeable parts for the factory itself.
And speaking of interchangeable parts, what about medicine? I mean, what are we seeing in terms of medical breakthroughs in automation?
Well, that's the other area I was just going to mention because that's a perfect application area. It's being used, for example, very widely in drug discovery. So there's these robots that you never see, but they're back in back rooms of all the pharmaceutical companies every day patiently testing thousands and thousands of drug combinations, molecular compounds to try and find out what works.
Wait, how could a machine? I thought they had to test it on animals or humans or something like that.
No, they're just doing it where they can test these chemically. But the chemicals the tests are complicated because they have to heat them up, they have to cool them down, they have to provide a whole series of steps. And that, when it's done by humans, there's a lot of opportunity for failure. But with machines, it's much more reliable.
And again, they're much happier doing things over and over and over again.
That's the thing. They're reliable. You don't want to miss one. I mean, you just overlook one little mixture, one compound, and it could be the miracle drug that you've been looking for.
What about your job and mine? Are they going to be automated?
Well, I'll tell you, one area that's interesting is they're introducing more and more podcasts into the university. So we've been asked to podcast all our lectures. And I do have a little concern. Because
So that automates the process of replicating. You don't have to show up every day to do a lecture. You do it once, and then they can broadcast it all over the world.
Right. And the question is, though, what about next semester or next year?
Hey, we don't need you anymore.
Right. So I maybe my job will just be, you know, answering the questions that might crop up.
Well, it's interesting. I just joined my wife, and I happened to be in the room, and my wife got a mammogram and some other tests, and I was watching the radiologists painstakingly go through the X-ray films and the other data. And again, very, very labor-intensive and an extremely important thing to do. You don't want to mess up on that. Why couldn't that be automated? Why couldn't there just be a printout that says normal, not normal, you know, look at this area? I mean, it strikes me that that's a ripe area for automation.
Well, that's a very interesting one you mentioned, Larry, because the idea of pattern recognition in those kind of settings is something that researchers are looking at. So they basically want to train a system with expert radiologists who will give them lots and lots of mammograms, and then the system will try and build statistical models to be able to differentiate, say, something that has cancerous cancerous lesion from one that doesn't. That is still a challenge. And again, the stakes are so high, we don't want to make a mistake. I'll tell you another example where we're working with UCSF, and we're working with the team that puts radioactive seeds into patients with prostate cancer.
Yeah.
And one of the challenges there is to get the seed to the right location. And that's very hard. When a human does it, they're essentially operating on sort of a little bit of intuition. And it won't replace the doctor, but we can guide the doctor's needle more accurately to a location than a doctor can do alone.
Which brings up the whole issue of nanotechnology, the ability to miniaturize and create devices that can kind of, on their very own power, sort of get to places where humans can't.
Yeah, that's another very interesting area that, when you look at medicine, we're, you know, on two fronts, we're developing more, better and better imaging techniques. And then the other part of it is, how do we get in there to those locations we've now imaged? Mm-hmm. And the idea is, we would like to have, for example, ultra minimally invasive surgery, where you're not just poking a hole, but you're actually just giving someone a pill, and those things will go in and it will be able to do some useful work inside the body.
I know this is a broken record, but what about the fact that we're replacing workers?
Well, okay, so the argument I always make is that if you workers, if they look at something like automation as an enemy, they can say, okay, we don't want to see that. We want to protest it. But the problem is that if you do that, the job, your company will not be competitive.
Mm-hmm.
So in a certain amount of time, and we see this in the U.S. auto industry, in a certain amount of time, everybody's going to lose their job. So it's much better to essentially automate, increase the quality of the overall product, and then that will end up being more work for everybody.
Right, assuming you can find other jobs. And we do have a relatively robust job market, though unfortunately, too many of those jobs are at pretty low wages.
Yes, but there's the idea that there's just so much work to be done. I mean, any one of us just feels like there's no shortage of work out there.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, like you, I'm a former academic, and I remember what it was like writing a doctoral dissertation in 1981. And it mostly meant spending a lot of time on the elevator in the library, going back between the stacks on the 32nd floor and the card catalog in the basement. That when I look back at what I did to earn my doctorate degree, I would just guess that 75% of the time I spent would no longer be necessary. It was typing and using whiteout. It was going to the driving back and forth to the library to gather my materials. There was an awful lot of activity that we academics back in the 80s used to do that academics today no longer have to do.
You know, that's a perfect example. I mean, you actually did mention one of my pet areas of automation, which is the elevator, which is there's still a lot of room to improve those. But here's an example. When you did your dissertation, you know, as you said, now sitting on the web, dragging and dropping, you can put together huge amounts of information without leaving your seat. The interesting thing is it still takes 5 to 7 years to finish a PhD.
Are PhDs better, or are we just finding other ways to waste our time?
That depends on the student, but I think it's that the PhDs are getting better. We're just, what happens is we get more and more tools, and then we can dig deeper. Mm-hmm. We can do more.
Pile it higher and deeper, they say, PhD.
Yeah.
That would be the good news, is if what you're telling me is that students coming out of graduate schools know more, are more competent, have a deeper understanding, because unlike me, they didn't have to spend so much time doing what I now consider to be almost trivial work.
Right. I mean, also, the other thing is there's been a lot more research since then, so it's a lot more that they have to absorb and digest.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I do think that's a good thing. I mean, everyone said, well, you know, all these labor-saving devices, I mean, we're still working like crazy.
Right.
Yeah, and we don't have any sense of, like, with the Jetsons' age, that we're sitting back like George Jetson smoking our pipe.
Well, this podcast is an example. 10 years ago, it would have taken a reporter an entire day to do what will now take me the time it takes to have this conversation, plus maybe another half an hour to an hour to edit it, upload it, and get it on the air. And again, it would have been, so an 8-hour job is going to take maybe 2 hours maximum.
But what you'll do is 4 more interviews, right?
Well, that's the problem. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes, absolutely. Now, if they paid me more, I wouldn't have to. But no, but I mean, that, and I guess that brings up the whole question. I mean, seriously, about the way, and I know you're a scientist, not a sociologist, but it really does bring up the question of whether or not automation is our friend, or whether it's just creating more and more pressure on us to produce more and more, and is it really improving the quality of life?
And that's a great question. I mean, I also do artworks with students and installations, mm-hmm. and a lot of what I do there is a critique of technology, and underscoring some of the limitations and the dangers that can accrue from that.
Right.
And so I completely agree with you. I mean, I think that you're right. Have our lives improved in certain categories? Yes, but in others, I mean, we're busier than ever. And a lot of times I kind of long for the caveman days when I could just sit around with my daughter and my wife and, you know, sit in the cave for a while.
But, you know, I'm gonna proffer an alternative view that for some of us, I'm having a very good time right now. This conversation is going on a little longer than I had planned, mostly because I'm enjoying it. So there's an extent to which those of us who are fortunate enough to be sort of self-directed in our work, the upside of it is that I get to do 4 more interviews, and that's a positive thing for me.
Right. But yeah, and it's all self-inflicted, if you will, because what we do is we're interested, we're curious beings, so we want to take more on, we want more music, we want more TV shows, we want more podcasts, and the answer is, well, you know, if someone came along and they said, well, we can wave a magic wand and take all that away from you, it's like, no way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right, but it's a complex equation, right? We you know, as McLuhan said, whatever extends us is also, there's an amputation.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there's this other automation that teenagers go through called multitasking, where you have a 16-year-old who can watch TV, do her homework, surf the web, do email, exchange instant messaging, update her MySpace profile, talk on the cell phone, answer the landline, and by the way, get straight A's all at the same time so she can get into Berkeley. I don't know how that's possible.
I don't either. There's a generational shift that's happened, and when I see students these days, the way they work, it's like another species.
Well, speaking of species, this particular species has to edit this and get it up online, and unfortunately, that is not completely automated. So, Ken Goldberg, the editor of the new journal from the IEEE on Transaction on Automation, Science, and Engineering, and professor of industrial engineering and electrical engineering and computer science at Berkeley, thank you very much for joining me.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Larry. It's really a pleasure talking with you.